Yeah, somebody made a reference to the Crystal Gravy. That's the SNL sketch where they
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
I'll put my Joe Jackson up against any player in the circuit. The boy can hit, he can run, he can throw.
If he could read, he'd be perfect.
All right, everybody, this is episode 31 of Recotopia. I am Chris Atkinson.
I am Jeremy Scott.
Yes, and today's big recommend is Eight Men Out, our second John Sayles movie. So John Sayles gets the honor, quote unquote, of being the second, have the first director to have two movies on Recotopia. The last one was Lone Star. We did that early on in the run. How's everybody doing out there? Everybody doing great?
Yeah.
Got to see the YouTube and the Twitch going on. That's pretty awesome.
People look beautiful.
People do look beautiful, indeed. Anyway, glad to see you guys out there. And do you have any small recommends, Jeremy?
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
I do. I'm excited about these recommends. I finally sat down with my wife to watch on Netflix the documentary Inside the Mind of a Cat. Now, this is cotton candy. If you like cat videos, if you have cats and like them, you will enjoy this experience. It's an hour and 7 minutes long. It does have real science. They do talk to several people who are full-time cat researchers, behaviorologists, who have done tens of thousands of runs of various experiments and studies to reach some of the conclusions that they share. It's not all just cats being cute, though I should caution you, it is full of cats being cute. All different kinds, big ones, small ones, all different breeds, but there's actually some knowledge dropped in this documentary. For instance, there's a woman who found a skeleton remains of a small boy on Cyprus with a cat skeleton buried with him. And basically, her research shows that has to have been a pet because Cyprus didn't have any cats. This is back in the Neolithic era. This is before ancient Egypt was worshiping cats. So somebody had to intentionally put a cat on a boat with them and go to the island of Cyprus to live with their beloved animal. So it's the first evidence that goes way back before we thought of cats and humans having some kind of relationship. There's a lot of stuff that you may have already read if you casually read about cat studies now and then, like blinking your eyes slowly at the cat is a sign of letting them know that you are comfortable and you are safe, and they will sometimes slowly blink back to you. We have always interpreted that in my house as like, I love yous, even though it's much more about I'm comfortable around you or I'm comfortable right now. Lots of really interesting stuff about how to warm a cat up to you if there's a cat that doesn't necessarily seem to like you. Really interesting stuff about how cats in Japan are behaviorally evolving differently than cats in the United States and react in wildly different ways to new items and new surroundings. And this is largely because Japanese cats are almost entirely house cats and never leave the house. And they have smaller living spaces there. So new items, they don't ever meet strangers. New items, new people scare Japanese cats more than they do American cats. Really fascinating stuff. Breezes by, like I said, hour and 7 minutes. For anybody who likes cats or cat videos, I think you would really enjoy it. And again, it's on Netflix. It's called Inside the Mind of a Cat.
All right. Well, I'm definitely going to watch that because, I mean, I'm always trying to get inside the mind of my cats.
Exactly.
What in the world are they thinking about in this when they do this certain thing over and over again? What does that mean? And like, if I've just fed you and you're meowing at me, what is that? What's going on now? Like, you know, you don't need anything now, right? What's going on? Anyway, I will definitely watch that. I had a recommend from a friend to watch Emily the Criminal, and I have gone to see this. Aubrey Plaza, who I think everybody in the world loves now, there was a point in time where if you were watching Parks and Recreation, you felt like you were the only one who knew who Aubrey Plaza was or whatever. And now everybody's like on the Aubrey Plaza train. And that's good to see because she is awesome. Emily the Criminal is about this woman who is working at a catering place or a kitchen of some sort. And she lives with several other roommates who we barely ever see their faces. She comes into the house and talks to them or whatever. And it's clear that she's got some financial difficulties. She's looking for a better job, but the job interviews that she's going to inevitably lead to the fact that she's been in jail before, that she's been convicted of some sort of crime, or it was like battery or something like that back in, 10 years ago or something. And the first interview that she goes to, the guy says, well, we don't do background checks here or whatever. And then so she feels free to open up about certain things. And then suddenly he drops the bomb on him. Well, we found out that you had a battery charge or whatever, and she realizes that this was a whole sandbagging type of thing. So she leaves the interview, just saying why would you do this to me? Why would you do that to people or whatever? Just come up front and say this is what, if this is going to be an issue, just tell me. So she's trying to get a better life and everything. And she has a friend who keeps teasing this job that she might have, but just never comes through. And then finally, one of her coworkers gives her this number and says, go to this place, call this number. And this number, they call the number and they say, come to this place tomorrow morning. I'm like, okay. Of course, by the way, if you ever in this situation where somebody just gives you a number and tells you to call it and you don't know anything about it, and then they tell you to show up to some place the next morning, probably shouldn't do that. I'm just going to give you some life advice right there. But there would be no movie if she didn't. So she calls the number. She goes to this place, and it's like this a number of people who are brought in, and this guy comes up and says, okay, I want you to know straight up, you will be breaking the law today if you decide to do this. We're going to give you these credit cards, and you're going to go into the store, and you're going to buy this item using these credit cards. They're obviously like stolen numbers, something like that. It's like, you can leave right now if you want to, but if you say yes, this is what you're going to do. So her first job is to go into this department store and buy a TV using these stolen credit card numbers or whatever. And then she just comes out with the TV, and they wheel the TV in the back of a van. And obviously all these big TVs, they're going to sell somewhere down the road. So she does that, and she starts having trouble at her own job, like keeping up with her own job at this point, because she starts going back and wanting to do more of this stuff. But after one involving a car where she like nearly gets killed, basically, she goes to the guy who seems to have kind of a shine to her. And after all, she is Aubrey Plaza. So you're going to have a shine to her. But she says, why don't I just do this myself? So he teaches her how to do the stuff that he's doing and just do this stuff on her own. And obviously some complications arise from her doing that. And it goes into some pretty fun places. And there is a great moment where Aubrey Plaza has an interview with Gina Gershon in this movie. It's really fun what happens in that interview. I would highly recommend this. This is an unusual movie. Aubrey Plaza, obviously known most for comedies and stuff like that, but she's built quite a dramatic resume over the
years. She's got a dark side. I know she leans into it in her public-facing persona.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think even like her Twitter bio is basically like, I'm evil or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But she likes, like, this movie reminds me of Ingrid Goes West. I don't know if you saw that. She gets obsessed with a social media influencer and kind of single white females herself into that girl's life. And then did you see Black Bear, I think it's called?
Yeah, saw that. Yep.
Where it's like two different movies back to back where everything is interpreted differently. She's really good.
Yeah.
When she leaves, she's great at comedy. I don't want to take away from that at all. But she's really good at the non-comedy stuff. So this immediately hits my radar. But you're saying this is in theaters right now?
It is, but I think it's really close to being on streaming at this point, because when I saw it at our local Belcourt, and it was the last show. So so that it's probably going to be on streaming soon, is what I am assuming. And when I say soon, probably in the next week or two, probably is what I'm thinking. So
excellent, excellent. All right, I'm going to leave the world of movies behind for my second small recommend. Uh-huh. Return to the world of food.
Ooh, food, yes.
And I want to tell you about a sandwich I made. And it's a sandwich I'm going to make over and over again. Now, I'm going to call it a grilled cheese. You're going to call it a melt. I don't really give a crap. That's not why I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
All right, in Middle Tennessee, and I think Tennessee throughout, is littered with pulled pork barbecue restaurants.
Yep.
Most of them are takeout. I cannot speak to your state. I would guess there's a little bit of pulled pork takeout in most states, but it's like every other block in some areas of Middle Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
There are a handful, half a dozen chains. I have my favorite. I like to go and get a pint, maybe 2 pints of pulled pork, bring it home with the buns, and they give me 2 kinds of sauce. Red barbecue sauce, it's tangy, I don't like it. Almost clear, vinegary, light brown sauce, I love it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I always have leftovers. And usually I just throw them on a plate, put them in the microwave, and eat them. They're delicious that way. This time I decided to do something different, all right? So we're going to make a grilled cheese melt with pulled pork. And so I threw a little bit of oil and a little bit of shallots and a little bit of garlic into a skillet, all right? Now that is probably the start of 30 or 40 different recipes that I could make, because shallots and garlic and olive oil are God's ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
You let that go for a little bit. Then as they're starting to like get translucent, you throw in your cold from the refrigerator leftover pulled pork. And you work that around in that skillet with that mixture for just a couple of minutes. You're trying to heat it up because when we put it on the grilled cheese, it's going to help melt the cheese along with the heat on the outside of the bread.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could do this with American singles, and you're going to have a good time. I promise. But I am a cheese hound. So I use sharp cheddar. I used Havarti. And I used Gouda.
Ooh.
Three cheeses.
I like all of those.
Skillet reheated pulled pork. Use any bread that's your favorite. I happen to use a big sourdough with lots of crevices and crags in it. This is probably the best sandwich I've had that wasn't from a really nice restaurant. Probably the best sandwich I've ever made at home. So I wanted to share it on with you. You can interpret this recommendation several different ways. You could just make a grilled cheese with Havarti and Gouda and cheddar. If you don't have any pulled pork, you could use the pulled pork stuff, but not throw the skillet shallots and onion stuff if you don't have any of that.
Yeah,
but I'm telling you, this will change your life. Pulled pork and grilled cheese sandwich. Bam.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. That sounds amazing. I may even have to like hit you up for the instructions on how to make one of those at some point because that sounds so good.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Speaking of eating, I watched the 1931 Dracula the other day.
Ooh.
And I wanted to, I have a 4K version of this. Now, when it gets to, you know, 4K movies from this era. I don't know how much you're getting in return here. Like, it's not like, I don't know if you can make it look even more spectacular than it already is or whatever. But the 1931 Dracula, obviously it's 90 years old, so it's not going to have the same impact a lot for modern audiences as it did way back when. But there is something haunting about watching a movie this old and this famous. The way they shot it, especially when you see Bela Lugosi's performance as Dracula in this, where it's a lot of like stares and like wide-eyed looks at people, and you're like, what the hell is he? Why is he staring? What is this? Think about an audience back in 1931 watching this in a theater. Because the people in here, we've seen so many crazies now in movies and like real life that, you know, this type of behavior, that's old hat. You just go outside and find these people. But like, it's a movie that you want to watch just to see way back when, how they were able to create a mood about things, and the way they do it with their lighting and cinematography and this black and white and, you know, and everything. There's something about it that, like, you know, you watched it in 1931, it was a modern movie, it was very scary probably back then, who knows. It may have not been too scary for some people, I don't know, but you watch it now and it feels like you're going into an old house, and you're really in fact going into an old house the way this is shot now, where it's just, you know, where the way you look at it now, you're actually exploring this relic yourself, and it just feels that old when you walk in. So yeah, there's some moments in this that are like very 1931 and just kind of like, okay, you know, that's not. But this movie's an hour and 15 minutes. You can't go wrong. It's short. It's to the point. And Bela Lugosi is awesome in it. If you've never seen the original Dracula, I would say go watch it. You're going to have moments where you're like, okay, some of this is, I don't really need any of this, but. But the way that they do the horror in this is amazing, I think. And just the way it puts you in a mood throughout. There's a reason why it's a classic. And so I recommend it if you've never seen it.
I have never seen it. I've seen a lot of movies from the 30s, but not this one.
Yeah. Go
ahead.
It's just a different way. I mean, why I would recommend it to you in particular is just that I think you would look at it with that kind of modern day eye and be like, man, there's some things they did back in 1931 that I didn't know that they could even do, you know, that kind of thing. And Bela Lugosi himself and the guy who plays Renfield in this, they're all like, they're bringing it, man. They're just bringing it. And awesome. Everybody else is like bland. I mean, the guy who plays Van Helsing is pretty good, I guess. But like everybody else is kind of like bland, you know, like who gives a fuck about these people? you know, whatever. Well, let's get some Bela Lugosi in here already. I think you might enjoy this. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like I might. I'm going to have to check that out.
Yeah.
All right.
Alrighty.
And now it's time for this week's Big Recommend.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
1988's Eight Men Out.
Mm-hmm.
This is a fascinating movie for me personally because I had probably seen Field of Dreams 15, 20 times
mm-hmm.
before I ever saw Eight Men Out. And there's a lot of Shoeless Joe Jackson talk, in particular in Field of Dreams. Kevin Costner's character is the biggest Shoeless Joe Jackson fan you'll ever meet.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to proselytize to his daughter about the wonders of Shoeless Joe Jackson. And does not believe he threw the series like all the other players. Statistically, if you look at it, you can tell. Anyway, so this movie takes that particular scandal of the Thrown World Series of 1919 between the Chicago White Sox and the Cincinnati Reds. Shoeless Joe Jackson is just one member of the White Sox. And there are a handful of others, I'd say around eight or nine, I believe. I think it's eight. Oh, it's Eight Men Out. It's in the title. Duh.
Mm-hmm.
Who are charged with a conspiracy after the series is lost to throw the World Series in exchange for money, which many of them did, and many of them ultimately will admit, at least to the camera. Buck Weaver, which is John Cusack's character, he never took a dime, and he played really good the whole series, and somehow he ends up wrapped up in this trial at the end, and it really pisses him off,
mm-hmm.
Justifiably so. Joe Jackson is portrayed by this film. I don't know if we'll ever know for sure. It's portrayed by this film as too unsmart to really understand what's happening.
Yeah.
And he's strong-armed, into, I guess, accepting this con and being a part of it by one of the players who just basically says, hey, you don't want to go against the other guys. All the other guys are in. You don't want to be a snitch,
right.
Do you? And he's portrayed rather simple in his mind in terms of his goals. He just wants to play baseball. He doesn't want to get in any trouble. but he's portrayed as illiterate, which I believe he was in real life. everybody else, Charlie Sheen, Michael Rooker, Daniel Sertharin, all of them take the money and play bad baseball on purpose. And I think it impacted the world of baseball and sports from then on to the degree that Pete Rose, you know, was kicked out of baseball for life for gambling, for doing this very kind of thing, even though
yeah.
he wasn't throwing games. He was often
like
betting on his own team.
One or two years after this movie came out.
Yeah, that's true. That's mm-hmm. interesting. And so you just have a great cast here. And we follow from the beginnings of the conspiracy right before the World Series starts all the way to the trial and the final verdict of the hard-ass commissioner of baseball. And it kind of paints most everybody with a little bit of sympathy. Comiskey, the guy that owns the team, is just a tight ass. He screws over his players. He had promised David Strathairn's character, Seacott, a $10,000 bonus if he won 30 games that year. And after he won 29, Comiskey forced the coach to bench him for 3 weeks. He missed five starts. And did not get his 30 wins and therefore did not get his $10,000 bonus. I also want to talk about, before I get too much further, the amounts of money we're talking about and how small they are.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't get $10,000 from Comiskey for his 30 games, but he agrees to be a part of this conspiracy for $5,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked it up. The equivalent to 2021 would be $78,000.
Really?
And I don't think any baseball player would go, you're going to pay me $78,000 to throw an entire World Series? Because, of course, baseball has been corporatized to the point where now players are bazillionaires.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no incentive for them to take money to throw games. But even back then, this was not a huge amount of money. These guys were just that pissed at their owner, who didn't probably even pay them the base salaries that they were worth. And so that's why they were able... in fact, it's Christopher Lloyd's character who overhears players grumbling about the owner, and he kind of sets the first domino in motion. He goes to a guy and says, hey, I think some players are upset. I think they could probably be bought to lose the series. What about your boss? He goes to his boss, and that guy says no. So this guy decides to do it himself. Then a different guy comes to that boss and says, how about it? And that boss says, yes. Everybody has a racket in this movie. And I think that's one of the underlying themes, because in the first few minutes, you see two little kids outside a baseball game, and one of them is just crying and crying. And some adult turns and hands his brother a coin and says, go buy him something to shut him up. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they put the coin in that kid's hand, the kid stops crying, and they basically exchange smiles. Everybody's got some kind of an angle or a racket going here.
But before you go further, I was looking at, now I'm looking on a random inflation calculator. So this could be completely wrong. When I heard 79,000, I was like, man, it seems like it would be more. 10,000 would be more. but a random inflation calculator that I've looked up said that would be $171,000.
From
1919. If you got $10,000, if something cost $10,000, sure, it would cost $171,000.
That's pretty close then, because what I looked up was the $5,000 valuation.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
That's where I got the $78,000 from. So that's pretty close.
Yeah. I mean, if we cut that in half, yeah, I didn't think about the $5,000.
The point ultimately to me is that I think these guys did it more because they were angry at Comiskey than because of the money.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, after they throw the first couple of games, the coach, who's played by John Mahoney, the dad from Frasier, he knows right then. He suspects from the minute one in game one, but after the second game, he knows. And he goes right to Comiskey and says, I think they're throwing this series. Comiskey goes right to the commissioner of baseball and comes out of his hotel room and doesn't say a word and disappears because he has been told off. And I'm sure the commissioner at that point is probably saying, you don't want anyone talking about people throwing a baseball game. Yep. Shut your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then the gangsters and the gamblers decide not to pay the players, or to pay them little tiny bits of what they'd promised at a time to keep them on the hook.
Yeah.
This tests some of the players who, at least at one game in the series, decide, fuck it, we're playing good, and they win. They win. They end up losing the series 5-3 because back then they played 9 games in the World Series. So they did win 3 games in the series, but statistically, if you look at this series, it's pretty clear that most of these guys were not trying very hard. They were, on paper, the best team ever assembled. They should have crushed the Reds.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I think I'll just throw it out to you and see what do you have to say. What were your thoughts this time through? I have several notes that I want to get to, but they're all kind of specific-y.
Yeah.
In general, what were your thoughts?
It was funny. Last week, I thought that the line that Michael Rooker said was said with a lot more, like, disgust than he did. Because now, rewatching it, it's more of a one-liner. When that guy approaches him, sort of, hypothetically, if we were to get a team to throw the World Series, what would you think it would take to get that? And then Rooker goes through that whole thing about you need two pitchers, you needed a couple of infielders and a couple of the heavy batters and blah, blah, blah. And goes, I can't imagine any ball players wanting to throw a World Series. And he goes, you've never played for Charlie Comiskey. This movie, I've seen this probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 times over the years. It's funny because there's so many baseball movies that came out during this era. You had The Natural, you had 8 Men Out, you had Major League, which also had Charlie Sheen in it. You had Bull Durham, you had Field of Dreams. Baseball was a sport that studios really wanted to put out content for, and now they really don't ever. Baseball is not that sport anymore. But I think, if I recall, this is the only instance where it was sent to some sort of high profile thing, like gambling and throwing games and things like that were common, I think, back in this era. But this is the one that eventually got you know, sent up to the moon because this is such a great team and like this team should have demolished them. I love the opening of this where it's back and forth between introducing our characters and it goes to Comiskey, who is very proud and very like, you know, like it's not a matter of if we're going to win this, it's how many games it's going to take. And do you think it'll be any more than you think you'll be able to win it in six? It's like, well, yeah, we'll be winning win it way before then or whatever, or something like that, which is, you know, basically a sweep. So I love how it starts, where there's this, where we get all the different characters, their angles, even the very first, one of the first lines you hear in this movie, the camera's going through the stands and you hear that person go, I bet you $2 he does. And you can bet me $2 he doesn't. And that's it's something that sets the whole tone for this movie, because gambling is such a huge part of enjoying sports for many people. It's funny looking back at Arnold Rothstein, and like that guy died when he was 46.
Wow.
He died because he had a poker debt that he didn't pay, and he got shot to death in New York. And I'm sitting there thinking, Michael Lerner. I love Michael Lerner to death. He's a guy who's been in nearly 200 things in his life. The guy has been in so many things, and he got nominated for an Oscar for Barton Fink. And if you've never seen Barton Fink, good movie to go and watch. But Michael Lerner, I was sitting there thinking, Michael Lerner is probably a little bit too old to be playing Arnold Rothstein here. But nope, he wasn't. He was playing like 47. He was like 47, 48 when he was playing Arnold Rothstein there. And I love the whole, like, you know, the... I love the discussion about why he can't get personally involved. This is something that a lot of people, wouldn't even consider with betting lines and things like that. If Arnold Rothstein goes to some sort of betting house and says, I want to put it all on the Reds, then the odds would just go straight down. You wouldn't be able to make any money off of this anymore. It's an interesting thing that I don't think a lot of movies would even cover, really. Like, they wouldn't cover the fact that the betting odds would be so out of whack just because of him going in. And I love all the stuff that he's got this insulation, basically, where it's insulation where nobody's really sure if he's in on it or not. And even in real life, they've never been able to prove that he was in on it or not. A lot of people think he was, for sure, because that was the type of thing he would do, but nobody really knows if he was really involved in all this. But you have these people, the little guy getting screwed in every instance in this movie. And when Christopher Lloyd and his buddy show up to try to come up with this idea and everything, they are instantly just like kicked out of this club once they come up with the idea. They go to basically a middleman who, I think the middleman ends up getting more money out of this than anybody. What is his name? The guy that
Artie.
It's like something with
an A. He ends up in Mexico though.
Yeah. It's Sport Sullivan is his name. I think he makes out like a bandit on this. But there's a point where they finally, when those guys get some money, basically a finder's fee, I guess, for doing this in the first place or whatever. I couldn't follow exactly how they got cut out of all of it, but it sounds like they were looking to get some sort of finder's fee out of it and then maybe place bets using that money on the Reds and then get well, but they didn't have any money. So they get thrown a bone at one point, and then that's when the White Sox win the game, so they lose everything. I love these performances. I love seeing all these people, and I love the choice here because Shoeless Joe Jackson is the star of this team, which you would think John Cusack would be playing in this movie. But John Cusack is playing Buck Weaver, and there's an obvious real reason why he's the one playing Buck Weaver in this, because Buck Weaver has the story of not having anything to do with this. And he has the more interesting dramatic arc out of all this. Although maybe there's so little known about Shoeless Joe's involvement in this. He never really said much about it. I don't know. But yeah, D.B. Sweeney is a fine actor. Don't get me wrong, but back in 1988, John Cusack was the high wattage. So it was kind of,
sure.
It was kind of, it's an interesting thing. Cause I remember years later when somebody brought this movie up, I thought John Cusack did play Shoeless Joe. Mm. And this guy was like, no, he didn't. And I was almost about to get into a bet with him, funny enough, about if whether or not John Cusack played Shoeless Joe in this movie.
Well, and as Joseph says, Buckweaver is really like the main character here, right? Mm-hmm. Like you said, he's the one that has sort of, you know, the arc that goes through all of it. I think as an actor, that's probably why he was drawn to that character,
yeah,
instead of... now, if they've written the script to make Joe Jackson the main character, Cusack might have gone for that role.
Yeah.
And
it's interesting, too, just because Cusack is a Chicago guy, too. So
yeah.
So this must have had a lot of personal meaning to him as well.
I think so. I love the two sports writers. One is played by John Sayles himself.
Yeah.
And the other is played by a man named Studs Terkel.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they act as sort of a Greek chorus, I think, in this movie. Every now and then we cut to them and they wryly observe on the goings on of the series.
Mm-hmm.
And then, except for one scene where Sayles walks through a train car that has the players in it and sings "I'm Forever Throwing Ball Games" instead of "I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles."
Yeah.
It's a great scene because he's basically just laying it all out there and nobody says a word.
Mm-hmm.
But except for that one scene, they're really like the Statler and Waldorf of the movie, just kind of chiming in from what is likely and most often the case, the most accurate perspective of what's going on. Like after the trial ends and the confessions are all mysteriously lost, mm-hmm, and so all the players are acquitted, it cuts to them and Sayles goes, "That was a bigger fix than the series."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's just sort of serving as the commentator for us, you know, to sort of line us up with what we're watching and what we're supposed to take away from it. It's one of my favorite things about this movie is how we keep cutting back to their little exchanges with one.
Yeah. And Sayles putting himself in his own movie doesn't seem like a stunt, kind of like what you see with a lot of directors. He looks like he's actually playing a part in that movie. And he's playing Ring Lardner, who I think his son, Ring Lardner Jr., was one of the, was like a screenwriter who was blacklisted during the, during all the whatever
McCarthyism?
The McCarthy stuff. I think his son was blacklisted during all that. Wow. Ring Lardner Jr., I believe, wrote the play for MASH, or he wrote something having to do with MASH. I can't remember what it was, but
that's good trivia.
It's just populated with all these characters, and I just love Michael Rooker. I just love hearing him talk. I love hearing, like, and the all through this, he's just, it's so funny. He's the one who's really guiding this fix. And there's a point where one of the pitchers, the lefty guy, comes up to him and says, is Seacott still on? Seacott's David Strathairn. Is he still on board? And he's like, yeah, man, he's still on board. He's obviously like, he's not convincing at all. And, but like, he's got this confidence all the way through. Like it doesn't even matter if I'm doing this, I'm just making money. It doesn't matter. And like during the trial, he's just smiling and laughing because he knows it. Mm-hmm. He knows the fix is in there too.
Yep.
There's the moment also they make the Kennesaw Mountain Landis the commissioner for life. One thing that you cannot know from this movie is that's one of the all time, I don't know if you want to use the word all time, but he was one of the biggest reasons why integration in baseball did not happen for a very long time. And so, you know, the hiring of him in this movie is seen as sort of a double-edged sword, I think, because he's asking to be commissioner for life and the owners don't really want that, but they also know that they're in quite a jam here if the White Sox are caught if they are perceived as guilty of doing all of this. There's so many things about this movie, so many aspects that you can go and explore on this. There's so many little avenues and details. It's really fun. I also like the fact that John Cusack and John Mahoney play in Say Anything the next year too. There's a point where they have two different distinct conversations. Mahoney is asking him, you know, what's the matter with you? And there's a real father-son relationship going on there. That's really good. And then of course the next year he's dating her, who's playing his daughter in the movie, in Say Anything after that. It's just a fun little, 1-2 connection there.
I love sudden Nancy Travis.
Yeah.
Being Eddie's wife, but she makes the worst bet I think I've ever seen in history.
Yes.
Because she does not bet for her husband to win. She bets the man in front of her that her husband is going to get a no-hitter.
Yeah.
In a World Series game.
Yeah.
And she lost that bet as soon as she spoke it. I understand, Karen. Anyway, I also love this poor fucking catcher who not in on it, and I'm shocked he doesn't catch fire at some point during one of these games, because it's just all of his scenes are just him losing his mind that these players are doing this. Like, he's so angry. It's one of my favorite things.
And it's like he is still innocent enough in this movie that he could have told him that they were throwing the game and wouldn't have believed it. That's how much he's into this. But then by the end of it, when he's getting interviewed by that guy looking for the article, he's like, all day I was asking for fastballs and he kept throwing curveballs. I don't know what the hell's going on, you know. So he probably did, but he was. It is funny. Like every single play, he knows. You would think he knows what's going on, but he's yelling at him anyway.
When Seacott comes over and cuts off the throw to home,
yeah,
with Jackson would totally have gotten that guy out. The catcher just goes, "Why did you cut that off?"
Yeah.
Oh man.
And then it has a very interesting ending too, where Shoeless Joe is playing in a bush league at the end of it. And I feel like this doesn't have to be in the movie. This scene doesn't have to be, but no. I feel like Sales wrote this and he was like, I really want to have this in here. And it's a great scene. I'm glad he has it in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But people in the bleachers sitting there talking about, like, I haven't seen that guy before. Who's this guy? And he said, you know what? You know who it is? It's Shoeless Joe Jackson. Like, who's that? Shoeless Joe. Shoeless Joe. He used to be one of the best players in the world or whatever. And then by the end of it, you see Cusack on the Buck Weaver in the bleachers. And they're like, I used to see Shoeless Joe play. He's like, what, do you think it's him? He's like, nah, it's not him. And he goes and run. They keep asking, why is Shoeless Joe playing so shallow? Why is he playing so shallow? Is he going to get burned on this? And guy hits a ball like all the way to the wall and he runs it down. To think that somebody would be even better than this player is kind of an interesting topic in these bleachers. But I love that ending scene.
I wonder if that is speculated that he went out. I love that because we're in like 1920, the average person cannot confirm by looking at a person in front of them if that's Shoeless Joe Jackson or not, because it's not this age of photographs being everywhere,
right?
Baseball cards being everywhere, and they have this honest debate: is it him or not? And they're going by his playing ability, not his facial features, not the giant wad of chaw on his cheek.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, I really, really enjoyed this movie. I hope that the listeners and live viewers enjoyed it as well. I am very excited to see what our super secret surprise double feature is going to be.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Of course, I will go through the usual requisite not double features.
Of course.
The first one is The Natural, and not just because it's baseball, but there is certain elements of The Natural that that flow along with Eight Men Out, and there's even a moment at the end when the Knights are trying to win the pennant at the end of the movie that the owners are paying off the pitcher to throw the game because they have, you know, they have more interest in losing than they have in winning. So there's some gambling elements in The Natural, especially by the character Gus Sams, played by Darren McGavin. But, so The Natural would be a very, very natural, didn't mean the pun, double feature. I'm not going to go with that. The other one I'm not going to go with, is Quiz Show. Which is about you know, fixed quiz show games and then eventually being told to take a dive. And their quiz show would be an excellent second feature with this movie. Ended up with Let's Just Keep It in Chicago, Baby, The Untouchables.
Ooh, I sent Aaron a prediction that would have kept it in Chicago, but that's not what you chose.
Oh.
My prediction was The Sting.
Sting would be good, yeah. Yeah.
But Untouchables, yeah, baby, because movie rules.
Yeah, The Untouchables, you know, it has the gangster element. It's not, you know, much gambling going on, but it's the Chicago of it. And Eight Men Out is so Chicago. It, you know, Chicago is definitely sort of a character in both the movies. And so to put it, The Untouchables, and you have Rothstein in one, and then you have Capone in the next. And man, talk about a cast that you could do some 6 degrees separation with this movie and The Untouchables. Holy crap. That's a lot of star power right there, man.
Yeah, it is.
So, The Untouchables, I think it would have been about, 10 years later, 10 years after this, somewhere around there, because that's when Prohibition. Anyway, that's the one that I came up with. I think it's a good one. So
I like it. I like that pick a lot. And I think honestly, Untouchables is a good double feature for any movie.
Yeah, pretty much.
Paddington 2, Untouchables.
Paddington 2. Yeah, absolutely.
all right. So what is our homework for next week, good sir?
Homework for next week. I'm going back into the comedy realm, although it's not just a comedy. Kung Fu Hustle. this movie came out here in 2005. I believe it came out in 2004 in China. But this movie is just madcap fun. It's like a Warner Brothers cartoon, live action cartoon almost. I haven't seen it in forever. So I want to rewatch this and see if it's as good as I remember. So yeah, this is
the same guy who made Shaolin Soccer.
Shaolin Soccer, yes.
Okay, awesome. Then I have seen this and I remember loving it, but I've only seen it once.
Yeah,
so.
Same here. So Stephen Chow is the one who made this.
Okay, yeah. It looks like Kung Fu Hustle is on Hulu with a standard subscription, not a premium one.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like it's on Pluto, whatever the crap that is. And then available to rent at all the normal places.
I saw something on our Discord, I think, where somebody was like, so we need to get Jeremy on Pluto. It's a free service. It's ads, but it's free and it's got a lot of good movies and TV on it. I'm not sure about Pluto either. I don't have it myself, but, Joseph says Pluto, to my knowledge, is like Tubi, which Tubi is the exact same sort of deal. Looking forward to that. I haven't seen it in forever, so hopefully it doesn't hasn't aged poorly.
No, I don't think it will have. I'm excited. All right, so let's look at the time. Yeah, we got time for some questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
Let's get to the questions and get everybody out to lunch. If time travel were real, what is the stupidest, selfish thing you would use it for?
I would go back in time and tell my past self. We'd go back into 1998, and I would say, every movie in 1999 may not be great, but you want to watch every movie in 1999 and not watch every movie in 2005.
Oh, 2005 is the most notorious year in movies for you and by association.
One day I may run down the schedule in 2005 and you'll just guffaw at how many bad movies there are. There are surprising amount of good movies in 2005. There's just so many bad ones. Anyway, I would that's my selfish thing.
I mean, this is not my answer, but there were probably a few moments with girlfriends from my youth that I would go back and give myself better advice about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm making it sound like I knocked up 15 people. That's not really what I mean.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Only seven.
I just mean, you know, some early things like kissing was awkward as hell. What I really would do, because I have to go even stupider than that, is I would go back in time to eat foods or snacks that have been discontinued or eat at restaurants that have closed. So I remember I really liked Crystal Pepsi, and you can make fun of me all you want, but I would probably use a time machine to go back and try Crystal Pepsi again. I remember Chi-Chi's, the Mexican chain, that even though they went out of business because somebody died eating their food.
Oh, wow. I didn't remember that
place. It was a lettuce, listeria, some kind of thing. I think somebody died, and then they were sued, and then poof, you're gone. But they had some really good food. Stuff like that. There's a lot of snacks and candies from the 80s that they were really experimenting with, and they went away, and they don't make them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's me. If I had a time machine and I was going to do something stupid with it, it would probably be to get Crystal Pepsi.
Yeah, somebody made a reference to the Crystal Gravy. That's the SNL sketch where they I think it had that Right Now Van Halen song playing over it too, because that's what the Crystal Pepsi ad did.
Right now. Let's see. What else? We got any answers here? Any other answers? I remember Chi-Chi's. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Steel butterscotch soda. That's a pretty weird thing to do with a time machine.
Mm-hmm.
I like how specific it is.
Now, if you want to get all Time Traveler's Wife on this crap, would you want to go back in time and tell yourself about these girlfriends? Because would you have met your wife if you didn't? If you heard your future self tell
you, who's to know? I'm not trying to like get out of any of those old girlfriend situations as much as I'm just trying to give young Jeremy a better path forward in terms of like how to kiss a girl.
Oh, I see. Yeah,
things like this.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, that's the whole butterfly effect thing. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yep.
Butterfly flaps its wings in Central Park.
Right.
And you were never born. Mm-hmm. Moving on. What are your favorite DVD commentaries? My favorite one that I always go back to is the Ben Affleck Armageddon commentary where he makes fun of the movie. That is a good one.
Mm-hmm. I don't listen to as many commentaries as I used to. The last one I listened to was for Anomalisa. And I thought that was a really good one because just talking about I'm wondering if Anomalisa had a commentary track, because it had a behind the scenes, and just all the behind the scenes was crazy enough. But the ones that I remember, Alexander Payne on Election's commentary track's really good. There's a little bit of CinemaSins in Alexander Payne. Just a little bit. Every time I see a little bit of CinemaSins and a director when they're talking about their own work, I'm like, that's our people. He may not like us, but he's our people. The other one was Zero Effect, the Jake Kasdan commentary on Zero Effect. I keep thinking that one day I'm going to make Zero Effect a big recommend, but I don't think you can find it very many places except to rent it on Prime, maybe. But anyway, those two, Zero Effect and Election, had really good commentaries on them. Payne even put in a point where he shows Matthew Broderick on a phone, and he says, now notice the phone hangs up on the other end, but the dial tone doesn't come on afterwards, like a whole bunch of other movies do.
Oh, man. I can't remember the last time I watched a commentary. It was a very brief period of my life when DVDs were exploding where I would watch that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of fell off of it. Now I don't even think they do it very much anymore. But I do know that I watched... There was a period when my wife and I first got married where we didn't have cable and our antenna didn't pick up much of anything. So we just watched DVDs, but we only owned like six.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was Finding Nemo. We watched Finding Nemo over and over and over again. And we watched all the behind the scenes, like how fucking hard it was for them to figure out how to animate water at that point in time. And I do remember that the commentary talked about how that opening scene where that barracuda kills every baby and the mama except for Nemo was originally going to be flashbacks in the mm-hmm. middle of the movie. But they wanted you to bond. They wanted you to completely buy Marlin's overprotectiveness right from the start instead of explaining it to you later.
So, mm-hmm.
Anyway,
Answers over here, you got Polly saying the Akira commentary was amazing. That's Akira Kurosawa. So I don't know if he himself was on that commentary or what, but that's I bet that is interesting. Chris Backinson says obligatory mention of Tropic Thunder because after all, I don't get out of character until I do the DVD commentary. the James Gunn Suicide Squad one was great, as was Joss Whedon's Avengers. Jagged says Ghostbusters commentary. I've heard that one, and that one is very good. That has a lot of different people on it, I think. It has Reitman and Aykroyd, and a lot of people were on that one. The Spaceballs one, we were going to make the opening scene with the ship an hour and a half, but we were told no. That's really funny. And then Polly also says, I bet Sin City has an awesome commentary. Does it make the movie good? All right. Go on to the – we have one more question maybe?
Sure. Let's do one more question, even though I already closed my file. Because
I didn't know you did that.
No, you're good. What's your favorite shocking and unexpected movie moment? Like when Samuel L. Jackson dies in Deep Blue Sea, spoiler, or that girl in Final Destination gets hit by that bus?
Mm-hmm. DiCaprio getting shot immediately when the elevator hits the floor in the Departed. Like, you have an idea that he might die, but not like that sudden. Because in most movies, the star of the or one of the stars of the movie is going to get their moment before they die. But as soon as that elevator opens, it's like boom, he's dead. And then
he's like mid speech, isn't he? Like he's like giving a pep talk, and the shark comes up out of the water.
Oh well, you're talking about Samuel L. Jackson. I'm talking about The Departed.
I was reading about Samuel L. Jackson and I misheard you. I'm
no,
sorry.
No, Samuel L. Jackson is Samuel L. In the Deep Blue Sea. Yeah, he's giving a pep talk and the shark comes up and eats him.
My wire is crossed.
In The Departed, DiCaprio is just sending Matt Damon to jail, and then his buddy, played by Aaron Badge. James Badge. Goes in and shoots DiCaprio immediately, and then it becomes a comical series of people getting shot left and right after that. But the other one that I had on here was in Seven when John Doe is talking about David's wife Tracy while Somerset goes to find out what's in the box, because he's the only one who finds out what's in the box. The whole thing has been set up for all this, you know, what's he going to do? He's got two more victims. It turns out to be David Mills' wife. His head's in a box. Oh, my God. Oh, God. Oh, God.
He, talks himself out of it, like, five different times. Like, he's really on the edge. Those are both good. I wrote down... when that guy does that big sword routine and Indiana Jones just pulls out a gun and shoots him.
Yep.
Which I think was probably, if I remember it right, was not the way it was originally scripted.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those, like, Goodfellas going through the kitchen, kind of like happened magically on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wrote When Wash Dies and Serenity, Alan Tudyk.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though Whedon had never been afraid to kill characters, if he was going to kill somebody, you wouldn't think it would be the comic relief of the entire show.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I was a big Firefly fan, so that one was really shocking.
A couple of the answers over here. You have JC says, honestly, recently it would be the scene where Costner's character in No Way Out starts speaking Russian. Marvin getting shot in Pulp Fiction. Although, you know, it's funny. When I watched Pulp Fiction for the first time and John Travolta like turned around and there's that big gun in the camera, I was like, oh no, is he gonna shoot him? Chris Baggins
just shot Marvin in the face.
Yeah, Chris Baggins says, I think in Seven, when that completely dehydrated dude is still alive, is an even bigger shock.
Oh.
Yeah, it is kind of. I kind of expected that to happen, though, because especially when the dude comes over and says, you deserve everything you're getting, or something like that, you kind of had this feeling. But everybody's been dead so far, so like even if you think it might happen, it's still like a shock and a half when it happens, when the guy starts coughing all of a sudden. He's encountered more suffering than I've ever seen, give or take, and he still has hell to look forward to. The Sixth Sense, fun fact, I didn't watch that movie until my mid-20s, watched it for the first time and knew nothing about that movie until I watched it for the first time. Well,
wow.
Good for you, because I didn't.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah, I was spoiled on that, Doc. Yeah, JC brings up that the fact that the gun scene was only done because Harrison Ford had food poisoning. Yeah.
That's right.
That is one of the most beautiful facts in movie history, that they came up with that moment just because he needed to get the fuck out of there.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for coming out and participating on this episode. The next week is Kung Fu Hustle. I hope you guys enjoy it. I hope I enjoy it. I haven't seen it in forever, but I remember loving it. So it'll be interesting to look that one over again. Anyway, hope everybody has a good week, and we'll see you. See you next time.
Thanks.
Bye. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/CinemaSins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
What's up?
What's going on?
I'm doing my Dr. Evil face.
Yes.
Here is Mr. Aaron, sir. Hey, guys. Hey, guys.
I'm not hearing anything unusual.
It might just be a natural warble. It could be my natural Tuesday warble. Hop out and hop back in.
All right.
Hop out and hop back in. Hop out and hop back in. That was my favorite kindergarten song.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Actually, in kindergarten, we used to play skipping tag. I don't know if you ever did that, but... it was my favorite, but I got in trouble all the time.
Skipping tag.
So you had to, you know, skipping, right? It's kind of between walking and running, right?
Yeah.
And
I've
kids
never heard
skip.
Of skipping tag.
Yeah, so we had a big circle on the floor in our kindergarten classroom, and we had to skip around the outside of the circle and try and tag. Like, there was a person who was it, and everybody else was trying to skip away from them mm-hmm. in a circle. But I would always end up running, and then I would get disqualified, and they'd pull me out.
Oh, I see.
So... it wasn't that I was trying to cheat. It's just that I couldn't control myself. Mm. My 5-year-old self just had no self control, mm-hmm. and I went from a skip to a run like that. I also used to get in trouble because I wanted to play with the wooden grocery cart that had wheels,
mm-hmm.
Of all the toys in the room. But their girls wanted to play with that, and they would keep telling me not to play with that because the girls wanted to play with it. Which, in hindsight, gender roles.
Yeah, no doubt.
Like, just let me play with the goddamn shopping cart.
But if there was anything gender neutral, it would be a shopping cart. I mean, come on.
We had cool toys in hindsight. I bet the kindergartners today had even better shit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had working, rolling, wooden shopping carts and lawnmowers and all kinds of great little toys.
I don't remember what kind of toys there were when I was younger in school or whatever. I don't think I was much of a toy person.
Mm.
Like, I didn't have action figures when I grew up. I didn't have any of that. No Transformers, no G.I. Joes, nothing.
Wow.
So whenever people talk about like their favorite toys and stuff, I'm like, I'm struggling to come up with anything that I used to play with all that often. I don't think I did. I played with Legos a little bit, I guess. Legos were a thing. Lincoln Logs.
I had Transformers and I had Star Wars figures, mm-hmm. and yet somehow G.I. Joe was deemed not acceptable for me to watch
Weird.
Or participate in. So I didn't have any G.I. Joe toys. I never watched a G.I. Joe cartoon. And that, I think most every kid my age was a G.I. Joe and Transformers fan.
Mm-hmm.
But I was only a Transformers fan. Mm-hmm. And all the kids, whenever they would start talking about G.I. Joe, I'd be like, let's talk about Transformers some more.
I will say that I do believe there were GoBots in my life. I had GoBots. I believe I had GoBots, but not Transformers.
I had a submarine GoBot. Mm-hmm. I quite liked some of the GoBots, to be honest. They were, but even then, it was obvious they were just ripping off Transformers.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
But I quite liked a few of those things. Oh, man. So there's a new trailer I want to watch, but I haven't had time yet. It's that Babylon Damien Chazelle.
It's got Margot Robbie.
Yeah, and it's out, and I've had too busy a morning. I haven't been able to sit and watch it yet.
Yeah, I want to see that trailer too. Now that I think about it. I saw some images from it.
Yeah, they put out posters like yesterday. This is the new thing. They put out posters the day before, and then they put out a trailer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I understand.
The marketing has its own like release date schedule now. Like that's a thing people look forward to for some reason.
I saw apparently at this Disney. I also love this thing where now all these brands have created their own media blitz day where they can drop all kinds, like DC has DC Fandom where they drop all their trailers and all the stars come and reporters are all in the room acting like fanboys. And you just did the Disney one, the D23 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And James Cameron showed some scenes from the new Avatar movie and these people are writing about 3D being awesome again.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to lose my shit
mm-hmm.
if we go back into this era of everything doing 3D because 3D is popular. Because mm-hmm. I feel like we've safely gotten away from that in the last several years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reading things like he's doing things with 3D you've never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a lot of 3D before.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to, I mean, unless you can literally bring that motherfucking fish out of the screen right next to my shoulder in the back row and I can touch it, you're not really doing new things with 3D.
Yeah.
You're just doing new technology of 3D.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, I'll always reserve until I see it, but yeah, I don't have very high hopes for that being some savior for 3D. I'm not even interested in the movie in itself, so who cares? Even if the 3D is amazing, I have very highly doubt the movie is.
Yeah, that's the problem. And I think there's no question that he's a technology boundary pushing genius filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't always think he puts as much effort into the story.
Mm-hmm.
And even like Titanic, the first time I saw Titanic, I was blown away. I was like five rows back. It was such a freaking experience. And you step back from that spectacle and you watch Titanic as just a movie and it's cheesy as hell.
Mm-hmm. Anyway. You know, it's crazy to think that the amount of time between Titanic and Avatar, he almost matched that for the next movie. Like that's how much time has passed since Avatar. Actually, it's more time because Titanic was 97, Avatar was 2009, and this is 13 years. So he's
13 years.
He's going to have an even longer hiatus than he did last time. So he's made, he's going to be 3 movies in 25 years.
That's crazy.
After he had made, he wasn't prolific by any stretch, but he was making them like every 3 years at one point.
Yeah. Yeah, and then he slowed way the hell down. And I think he, whatever technology he created or discovered to make Avatar, I think he spent the time between Titanic and that developing and perfecting this visual technology. Because Avatar looked awesome. It looked awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I fucking hate that movie, but it looked awesome.
Yeah.
Also, Papa Dragon's back, I read.
Papa Dragon.
Papa Dragon. Mm-hmm. And he somehow has his own, like, he's also avataring into some kind of creature.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.